Hello, this is Bill Harris, and I want to welcome you to the Masters of the Secret series. Tonight's guest is my good friend Jack Canfield. In addition to being one of the stars of the hit DVD movie The Secret, Jack is the originator and co-creator of the New York Times number one best-selling book series Chicken Soup for the Soul, which has sold over 100 million copies in 39 languages, the last I heard. But Jack is certainly a lot more than that. He's one of the top self-esteem and success trainers in the world. His new book, The Success Principles, is a runaway bestseller. He does a lot of speaking for corporations and other groups, and the list of major corporations that have had him as a consultant or a speaker is really too long to list here. He's been on Oprah and Fox and Friends and CNN and countless other television shows. And if we gave his whole bio, we wouldn't have time to have a conversation. So, Jack, welcome. I'm really happy that you're here today.
It's always fun to be with you, Bill.
Well, thank you for saying that. You know, the first thing that occurs to me when I, you know, introduce you, as I have a few times, and tell... And I just told a few of the things that you've done. The thing that always occurs to me is, and I don't want to embarrass you by this, but there's something so human and warm about you, and so approachable that it's almost hard for people to believe that you have had this mega success that you've had. How have you managed to maintain so much humanness in the face of all this success?
Well, I always say that success or money amplifies who you already are. So if you're someone who is an idiot and you make a lot of money, you can be a really big idiot. But what happened for me was that I spent a lot of time before I was successful working on myself, taking lots of seminars. I think one year I went to 38 weekend workshops from Gestalt therapy to transactional analysis, meditation, yoga, Tai Chi, you name it. And literally did a lot of clearing out of, and you know, as much of my ego and as much of my, you know, self-defeating behaviors, et cetera, that I could. So by the time I was successful, I don't feel like I'm any different now than I was, you know, when I became successful, other than I have a lot more money and a lot more influence.
Exactly. And, you know, that's the same thing that's occurred to me as I have become more successful, is the influence it gives me really gives me an opportunity to do something good for the world, and I like being in that position, and I'm sure you do too.
Oh, I love it. I mean, we give away, you know, some years millions, some years hundreds of thousands of dollars to causes that we care about. I'm able to open doors and get audiences with people. I remember one year I was invited to speak to all the women members of Congress and the state legislatures and the women governors over in Hawaii. They had a big convention, and I said, well, what do you want me to talk about? And they said, well, whatever you'd like us to know. And so I got to, like, give my agenda for the nation to all the female legislators. I mean, what a kick.
Yeah, I know. That reminds me of when I was asked to speak at the United Nations and got to speak to a lot of influential people there. It's really... I'm amazed. I would imagine you probably feel that way too. I don't feel any different now than when I was making $30,000 a year.
No, I don't. I mean, I have a bigger house and more clothes and a nice car, and I can take my kids anywhere in the world that I want to take them. We were just talking before we got on this call about, you know, I just spent 2 weeks in Hawaii in a house on the beach, and the year before that we were in Bali, and next year we're going to India and so forth. And so I get to do that kind of thing, which I think is neat, and get really great medical care and eat organic food and all that. But other than that, you know, life goes on. You have to have some kind of driving vision or purpose that makes you get up in the morning. And for me, it's always been about, you know, empowering other people to live their dreams and then teaching other people how to teach that to others. So one of my big initiatives is, you know, educating educators, teachers in the high schools and middle schools of America to teach kids to believe in themselves, because there's such low self-esteem in so many parts of our country that, I mean, we just, you know, we've been watching the whole thing that's been going on in Louisiana with the hurricanes, and you see so many people at the bottom end of the economic ladder who just don't feel very empowered. And my goal is to continue to help people become empowered so that they can have the future they want.
You know, there have been a number of times in my teaching where I will give an example of some successful person. And I get letters back from people saying, well, yeah, it's okay for you to talk about, Napoleon Hill or Jack Canfield or some other super successful person, but they don't relate to it somehow. It's like someone that's really successful is so far away from where they are that it seems unreal to them. So I'm it's occurring to me as I say this that maybe we can do something as we talk here to help bridge that gap for people.
Well, I know for me that, there's a concept in psychology about gradient. And if you go too far above gradient, people can't relate. The example would be if you're making $50,000 a year and someone says, I can teach you how to make 100, that seems real. But if someone says, I can teach you how to make 1,000,000, that seems so far away, it's hard to believe. But if you're making $500,000 and someone says you can make 1,000,000, then it feels real. And for me, only, 20 years ago, I was making, $50,000 a year. And then the next year, I might have made 60, and then 75, and then 100, and then 140, and then 300, and then 400. So it's kind of like watching your own children grow. They don't look like they're getting bigger. But if you see someone you haven't seen for 3 years, and they go from 11 to 14, they've gained like 2 feet, and you can hardly believe they've grown that much. So what you have to do is, you keep looking at what's in front of you and doing that. And, when I set out to write a best-selling book, Chicken Soup for the Soul, I didn't think it was going to sell, 8 million copies around the world. I thought it might sell, 1,000,000, which was our goal. And as a result of that, we sold 1,000,000, and we said, well, what about making 4 million? And then one day we were sitting there, and we'd sold about 50 million books. We said, well, let's sell 1,000,000,000 books. Well, if you'd have told me, let's sell 1,000,000,000 books, when I did the first Chicken Soup book, I'd have told you you were crazy. So I think the main thing is to keep the horizon ahead of you always a little higher than what you are and keep looking toward that which you want to create. And eventually you find yourself standing on top of a mountain because you took one step at a time.
Yeah, I really relate to that. When I started Centerpoint, I was making about $30,000 a year, and I thought, wow, if I could make another $30,000, I would really be in clover. Mm-hmm. And I wrote out a goal then that was much higher than that, more than 10 times higher than that, and my hand was shaking as I wrote it out because it seemed ridiculous to me, which was because it was over that gradient. And things just sort of went little by little until it kind of hit a place where it kind of started to grow geometrically. And it took me a little while to get used to the idea that I could really make it really big. And then, you and I met in this strategic coach that Dan Sullivan has created, and Dan floated the idea of making your business 10 times bigger than it was. Mm-hmm. And when he said that, I said, well, yeah, why not? Whereas several years before that, it would have just seemed out of reach to me to do something like that.
Well, as you remember, one of the things that Dan said that really made it believable for me, he said, take what you're making now, and I think at that time I was making, several million dollars a year, and he said, go back to when you were making 10 times less, so that would have been $200,000 a year. And he said, when you were making $200,000, if anyone had told you you could make $2 million, would you believe him? And I said inside, no, I wouldn't have. And he said, but you did, didn't you? He said, so if you couldn't believe that and you made it, imagine now where you are, multiply that by 10, and realize you can because you've already done it. You've already done a 10 times multiplier of your income. And that made it reasonable to me that I could do that.
Well, and that's the way I felt too. I thought, gee, I did this once before. I was 10 times less and I did it. So it's, and certainly other people have done it. One of the things that I say to myself a lot is, if somebody else has done it, it must be doable. And if they can do it, then I can do it too. And that belief has really propelled me a lot of times to create things that at first would have seemed out of reach.
Well, that's really what happened with us in Chicken Soup for the Soul. Mark and I, when we wrote the book, the first book, we said, okay, who's already done what we want to do, which is have a best-selling book in the nonfiction world? And instantly came to mind John Gray with Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus, Scott Peck with The Road Less Traveled, Ken Blanchard with The One-Minute Manager, and you know, we listed about 10 people. And then we said, let's call them up and find out what they did. And we interviewed each one of them for about an hour. They were very gracious to give us their time. And we started looking for patterns. And one of the patterns was they did a radio interview every single day for a year. So we said, well, if that's what it takes, we'll do that. Scott Peck, whose book, The Road Less Traveled, was on the bestseller list for 12 years. I think that's a Guinness Book World Record.
Wow.
It was over 600 months, or 600 weeks, rather. What happens is we found out he did three radio interviews every day for a year and then one a day for the next 11 years, every single day, including Sundays. And he said, I'm a minister and I go to church on Sunday. You know, he's a lay minister. And he said, but I still would do an interview in the morning or later in the afternoon. And so we said, okay, if that's what it takes, we'll do it. So we did the same thing. And sure enough, a year and a half later, our book was number one on the bestseller list.
Well, you know, you've hit on, of course, one of the success principles you teach, which is to find other people that have already done what you've done and to model what they've done. And that's something that I have always done. And it was kind of a revelation to me. I think it was maybe when I was 35 or something, where I finally realized that most people don't do that. It just seemed like common sense to me. When I wanted to become a pilot, I went and I found the best flying instructor I could find, and I tried to figure out the best way to learn to become a pilot. When I wanted to become a musician, I did the same thing. When I wanted to learn how to do marketing, which has been one of the reasons why Centerpoint has been so successful, I found the best marketers, and I learned what they had done. Why do you think most people don't do this? They just don't know?
I think there's several things going on. Number one, I think they don't feel like they deserve it. Number two, they probably feel like, why would the best person in the world talk to me? And what I found is most of the best people in the world are great teachers, and they're really magnanimous. There are a few who aren't, and you're going to get rejections, no question. But if it only takes 10 questions to get one yes, why not ask? And, you know, Mark and I wrote a book called The Aladdin Factor, How to Get Everything You Ask For. And basically, you know, we found that there are some world-class askers out there. And, again, we went and interviewed over 50 of them, you know, from Mother Teresa on down to a guy who always buys everything, you know, wholesale, never pays retail. And we said, you know, how do you do it? And as a result, we began to look at why don't people ask. And one of the things we came up with is fear of rejection, a sense that you're not worthy, and a feeling that you don't deserve to have it. You know, some of it's conditioning. You know, I'm dealing with this with my stepdaughter, actually, right now, because she didn't grow up with me in her formative years. She's now 11. She's only lived with me about the last 4 years. I said to her the other day, you know, it's time for you to have your own computer. And she said, oh, no, I don't want you to waste money on me like that. And I said, what do you mean? She said, well, we have a computer in the kitchen. I said, what's your mom's computer? And you need to do homework now. She's in the sixth grade, and you have to type their homework. And I said, sometimes your mom's going to be on a computer, and you won't have access to it. You like to instant message your friends, and you'll be able to go to Google and do all the stuff. And she said, well, I better ask my dad. He might be mad. And I was looking at, there's this whole thing that she's grown up with that it's not okay to have the best stuff. Because I think, you know, they couldn't afford the best stuff, and so therefore the fear was in the family. If the kids want the best stuff, we can't afford it, so you have to learn to settle for second best. And then if after a while, you don't think you deserve first best.
Mm-hmm. So I'm assuming that in your self-esteem seminars that you do, you deal with this.
Yes, we deal with the idea that you deserve to have anything that the universe has to offer as long as you don't hurt other people in the process of getting it. And I believe it's an abundant universe. I believe there's enough for everybody. I think it needs to be distributed more equally, and the reason people hoard is they don't think there's enough. And so it goes back to, you know, creating the illusion there's not enough. But the fact is, you know, we have plenty of everything that's really important. You know, the most important things, as you know, are not things. It's love, the ability to express your creativity, the opportunity to, you know, both give and receive love, to feel competent, to make a difference in the world, and give and receive hugs and all that. And that doesn't cost any money. But there's also plenty of material things to go around as well.
Well, you know, my view is that the reason that someone would feel undeserving is because in some way they've been traumatized. I mean, what you described about your stepdaughter's upbringing is a form of trauma. being told those things and taught those things and being treated in a way as if you didn't deserve the best.
Mm-hmm.
And when people are traumatized, they develop a generalization about the world that it's a dangerous place, or at least a potentially dangerous place, and that they have to, you know, watch out for that danger in order to avoid it. And as you know, when you focus on what you don't want, what you want to avoid, your brain doesn't know that you want to avoid it. It just knows that you're focusing on it, and then it figures out a way for you to get it. And in a way, by her telling you don't spend money on me, she was doing what she needed to do to try to make that come true in that situation, as it had been in previous situations in her life.
Absolutely.
So what exactly do you do in the self-esteem seminar to move people to a place where they do feel deserving? You can't just tell them you're deserving and hope they'll believe you.
Well, you can go back, and as you said, you can find where does the original decision get created. It's usually an event, as you said. It's a traumatic event and a highly emotional event. And as you and I know from all the brain research we've done, that when you make a decision, when your brain is flooded with the nutrients and the, chemicals that are secreted under a highly emotional charge, those memories get locked in at a much deeper level. Everyone knows where they were when 9/11 happened, when President Kennedy was shot, et cetera, because it was such a traumatic event. And then if you get repetition, which we did, we saw those things over and over, if you have a traumatic event and then it's reinforced by your parents, you know, or peers or whatever over and over, it becomes almost like an unquestioned belief about the world. So we will go back through a process of closed eye processes and help people identify when they made those decisions, and then bring in a wise being, which represents the higher consciousness of their own self, to redecide a better decision, and to also heal that memory. There are a number of things you can do. You can imagine having the ideal parents. We call that resourcing, yourself. And because the brain doesn't know the difference between a real event and an imagined event, therefore you can actually put new memories in the brain and, if you will, crowd out the old negative ones.
Well, my assistant, Katie, went to your most recent seminar, and we almost had to tie her to her chair when she got back to keep her from spending all her time proselytizing to all the other employees about how wonderful you were and how wonderful the training was, and she was on cloud nine.
Oh, that's great.
And so I thank you for what you did for her, and I'm sure you did for the other people too. I know you're still working on more Chicken Soup for the Soul books. I know that's still going on. But other than that, what's your latest vision for where you want to go?
Well, I'm looking at a couple of things, Bill. One is I'm exploring with a major television network doing a talk show. It would be a talk show along the lines of an Oprah-type show, but we'll be focusing primarily on inspiring people and empowering them through the guests that come on to go for their dreams. And so we might have people on that, you know, have started a business at home, or the first female NASCAR driver. It'll be primarily a female audience in the daytime, so we'll focus more on that. And we'll reach millions of people, whereas now when I talk, you know, I might talk to an audience of 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 people. This would allow me to talk to millions a day, 5 days a week, and just reach more people. And the other thing I'm doing, I'm starting a new division of my company, which is a training division, to go into corporations and do even deeper work than we've been doing up till this time, with a number of people that you know, like Marsha Martin and Stuart Emery and so forth. So those are the two big initiatives. And then also we're developing a coaching program. We have an online program we're developing, and we're also developing a telecoaching course that will probably both be available starting in January. So those are the big things. And then lastly, I'm looking at doing a book around the topic of effortless success, you know, the idea that we're all working harder than we need to achieve what we want. It's more about consciousness than it is about effort, and it can be more graceful and easier. So those are the big things that are exciting me at the moment.
Well, you know, as you were describing the talk show, for instance, I was thinking, you know, that's a pretty big goal, to, mm-hmm. you know, to speak to millions of people. And I was sitting at my desk a couple of years ago, I guess it was now, and thinking, okay, how can I take CenterPoint to the next level? What do I need to do to expand the number of people who know about Holosync and are using it and benefiting from it? And I tend to ask myself a lot of questions. And that's the way I get information, really, is I ask the question, and then one way or another, the information, you know, comes to me to answer the question. And very quickly, after asking that question, I thought, what I need to do is get to know all of the big centers of influence, particularly in personal growth, so that they can get on board knowing how wonderful Holosync is and what it does. Well, it wasn't very long at all before you invited me to be in this Transformational Leadership Council group and several other things like that, some things that Marshall Thurber is doing and some other things came to me, just sort of almost fell into my lap, just like you say. It was really an effortless type of thing. And since I had that idea, I would say that at least 25 major centers of influence have started using Holosync and promoting it to their, to the people that they are influential around. So that's just an example from my life of the way it can be effortless if you know how to focus your mind in the right way.
No, it's so true. Example out of my life is when my book, The Success Principles, How to Get from Where You Are to Where You Want to Be, came out. I was thinking, I need to get national television exposure. And, it's either got to be Oprah or Today Show, and that's a one-time thing. But how do I get constant, exposure that goes on over time? Because not everyone watches those shows every day. And so I just kept visualizing it, not knowing how. I didn't have the money to go out and buy $40 million worth of advertising. But we got about 30 days later, we got an email addressed to info@jackcanfield.com, not even like to my name or address. And it was Carlton Sheets, who does the No Money Down real estate programs, and he was asking if I would come on and do a introduction for his 20th anniversary infomercial, which he was going to buy $40 million worth of airtime to promote. And I said, you betcha, because it was going to have me and mention my book and all that stuff and be in markets all over America all the time and, creating brand recognition for the book and for myself and so forth. So, and that just came out of the blue, we could call it. But the fact is, I believe I created that by simply focusing on what I wanted, which was television exposure.
Yeah, if the big struggle for me, I'm writing an article right now for our next issue of our newsletter, Mind Chatter, and I've taken a few quotes out of some letters people have sent me, and then I'm talking about kind of what I see in each of these people that's causing them to write me about how miserable their life is. And in every case, it's that they're focusing on what they do not want, pretty much automatically on autopilot, and not focusing on what they want. And in some cases, they don't. They even claim to not know what they want. So I continually tell people that I think really the key to everything is what you focus your mind on. And most people just don't understand how powerful their mind is and that they're already manifesting exactly what they're focusing on.
Yeah, I always say to my students, if you want to know what you're thinking, look at what you're creating around you. And what you thought in the past is creating your current reality. And if you want your future to be different, you got to create different thoughts. Because what you're currently doing will only produce what you're currently getting. And that's what most people don't realize, is that they keep recreating the same reality over and over, and they think they're stuck, but the fact is they're sticking themselves by maintaining the same habits of thought and imagery and behavior. And it's not easy to change without some kind of external support, because we're basically habit-driven people, and you can get so habitual you're in a trance. And it takes a coach or a book or a program like Holosync or a training like mine or yours to break people out of that, to kind of almost shake them awake, and then give them the tools of repetition that your programs do and my programs do, to take them to deeper levels of consciousness where they can think a higher level thought and expose themselves to the deeper creativity that already exists inside of them but they're numbed out to, so that they can, as you said, create a better life with less effort.
Well, you know, one of the things that I've noticed, and I know you've noticed this too, is that people will go to a seminar or a training, and they'll leave with seminar high, and they've got the best of intentions then for going out and creating whatever it is they want. But then within a short period of time, a week or so, their old habit of focusing on what they don't want most of the time reasserts itself, and that whole intention that they had kind of goes away. And it seems to me that a good seminar is one in which the seminar leader manages to get the people that are at the seminar to focus on what they want. But a great seminar is one that manages to get people to continue to focus on what they want after they leave. And I think that's one of the things about your work that makes it stand head and shoulders above, higher than a lot of other people's, is because I think you're able to do that. Can you give some explanation of how you try to make this more permanent rather than...
Sure. I think one of the things that we do that's unusual is that we provide people with a mastermind group or a set of what we call accountability partners, so that as you leave the seminar, it's kind of like, everyone makes New Year's resolutions to exercise. It's much easier to keep them if you sign up for a gym and you have a partner you're going to go with and a coach you're going to meet when you get there. Because then you've got people saying, come on, let's go, let's get in our suit, let's do 50 push-ups, whatever. And, on our own, we would tend to fall away from that. And so we teach people how to create and maintain a support system that keeps them focused on their goals. We also teach them a set of habits that we expect them to do for a minimum of 40 days, because research shows that if you can keep something going for 40 days, you're more unlikely to keep it going. And then we also encourage them to keep it going for a whole quarter, 3 months, if they really want to be sure. And so what happens is things like the mirror exercise, where every night at the end of the day before they go to bed, they look in the mirror, and out loud they talk to themselves and appreciate themselves for everything they did that day. And what that does over a 40-day period, it creates a habit of self-affirmation, self-validation, focusing on what you did do rather than what you didn't do. And so it creates some new mental habits. Everyone leaves with a set of affirmations, which they put on 3x5 cards or put on their screensaver that they have to read every day. We ask them to do that for an entire year. Then every, once a week, they're talking to their mastermind group. I recommend that people hire a coach and study with the best, as you know, and that's why you and I are both creating coaching programs. One of my friends said training without coaching is entertainment, and I think there's a certain truth in that, because a lot of people can relate to going and getting that training high you talked about, and then a month later it's like they were never there. And so we need that. Once we get the breakthrough, we need to sustain it. And so it's like teaching a kid. You don't expect them with one intervention to develop a new habit, like keeping their elbows off the table or chewing with their mouth closed or going to bed on time or studying with the radio off. But if you reinforce that over and over and over for days and months, eventually they internalize it and it becomes a habit. And what I'm looking to do is create what I call habits of success, disciplines of success that become second nature. And when you've got that, if you've developed 4 a year, as Dan Sullivan taught you and I, at the end of 10 years, you've got 40 new success habits, you're home free.
Absolutely. That this whole idea of holding people by the hand until they really make it a habit is why I answer, you and I have talked before about how many emails I answer. All the people in my online courses have unlimited email access to me. And many times in different clothing, they keep asking me the same question. And sometimes I have to answer it 10 times before they really get the principle I'm talking about. Sometimes it's 20 times. But eventually they go, oh, I get it. I can generalize this to other situations. I don't have to keep asking this. So I agree. I think that's a really important part of this is somehow supporting people while they're in that transition period.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to ask you, I know that one of your mentors was W. Clement Stone, who some people probably recognize that name who are listening, but W. Clement Stone co-wrote a book with Napoleon Hill, Success Through Positive Mental Attitude, and was a multi-millionaire. I don't know if he was he a billionaire? Or?
Well, when I knew him, he was worth $600 million, and that was in his 60s, so if you were to amortize that out today's dollars, he was a billionaire.
Oh,
yes.
In today's money, he certainly was.
Right.
So what was it like being around W. Clement Stone?
It was quite exciting. He was always positive. I mean, to a fault. You just began to question, was he normal? But he wasn't. And that was his strength. I mean, he literally believed the world was plotting to do him good. We used to call him an inverse paranoid. Literally. I mean, I think he's the guy who coined the phrase. I've been told this, I believe it. If life hands you a lemon, squeeze it and make lemonade, which was a kind of a more common way of Napoleon Hill's statement, which was, inside of every negative event is the seed of an equal or greater benefit. And he would always, always believe that. I mean, people came in to rip him off, and they would be so, because we had a foundation that I worked for him, where he gave away a lot of money. And some people just came to see if they could scam him for the money. And by the time they left, they were so impressed with the idea that he really believed they could do something legitimate that they would go out and do it. And he was a character, and he was a genius trainer. He trained people not by words but by action, by taking them out, modeling for them what good sales looked like. He was in the insurance industry. And he would go in, he would sell someone with a new recruit watching, and then he'd say, okay, what'd you see me do? And they'd tell him, and he'd say, well, you missed three things, and here's what they are. Next time we go in, just watch for those three things. And he'd take the person back, have another cup of coffee, and say, did you see those three things? He said, yes. So they'd be walking into the next one, and just inside the door, he'd say, this one's yours. And the guy would freak, but he'd say, no, come on, do it. And so he'd do it and probably miss three things, and they'd go out for coffee and say, what'd you miss? And if they knew, you know, great. If they didn't, he'd tell them. Then he'd go and he'd do those three things perfectly for them again. Well, by the end of the day, he had a perfect salesman. They were confident. They knew what to do. And he trained hundreds of people that way and built a huge insurance industry and eventually taught his training techniques to others that do it. So he was truly a gifted genius.
Well, that book, Success Through Positive Mental Attitude, was really influential in my life. So when I learned a few years ago that you knew him and worked with him, I've always wanted to ask you a little bit more. Any other anecdotes about him that are worth sharing?
Well, I remember one day we were in his office, and he went over to the side of his desk, and he just inadvertently, we thought, knocked a book on the floor. And he kept talking. And eventually he said, none of you are listening, are you? And we said, no. And he said, why not? He says, because we're wondering if you're going to pick the book up off the floor. And he said, you've got to be very careful about leaving people incomplete. They always want completion. And I know today in NLP they talk about closing loops and all that. You could probably speak more effectively about that. But he was a kind of a natural psychologist who just understood everything. And he was a great philanthropist. He gave away millions and millions of dollars. And one of the nice things about working at the foundation is we'd get a buzz on the phone, and someone from the Stone office would say, you know, he just bought 100 tickets to the such-and-such ball. You're all welcome to go for free if you want. So we went to some of the most amazing events in Chicago for free when I was in my early 20s. I was just amazed. He always, you know, you'd see him, and he'd say, how are you going? Terrific! You know, the only answer that was appropriate was terrific. And at first, it felt phony to me. But after a while, if you say it long enough, things really are terrific. And so you've got to go through that stage almost of, like, not believing a technique will work until it does. And then all of a sudden you go, wow, that's not faking it till you make it. That really works, you know?
Well, I actually have a lot of people who, when I talk to them about focusing on what you want, they'll write me and say, well, I tried this focusing on what I want, but I feel like such a phony. Because while I'm sitting there thinking about what I want to be, I know that I'm a loser and that I'm this and I'm that. And, then I get a chance for the second time to explain the principle to them, taking into account that misperception. And with the people that stick with me and keep coming back to me with all their objections, pretty soon I cover every objection they can think of, and they pretty much don't have any choice but to start focusing on what they want.
Right. Well, you know, one of the things that one of my mentors once said is we give way too much credence to reality. She said, because reality is simply something we created.
Absolutely.
And as long as you realize you're a creator, you know, we're all made in the image of the creator, if you believe any of the great religious texts in the world, then what happens is the reality we're currently living with is simply one we created. And so we get to either focus on that and have more of it, or focus on the reality we want and create that. And most people think that, you know, statistics say that, you know, 80% of marriages end in divorce or whatever, therefore, you know, I have an 8 in 10 chance. And so that's what they start to believe, and sure enough, they create it, as opposed to saying, well, that's just a statistic of what got created in the past. I'm different. We know more, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I'm going to create it my way. And that's, you know, it's what you do every day. It's what I do every day. It's what all of us who are teaching this stuff do. It's why we're the teachers, because we live it.
Yeah, it's just, it's a really a challenge for people when they're going in the direction where they're focusing a lot on what they don't want and getting it, to believe that they're actually doing that. And part of that is that they're really unconscious about what they're doing inside that's creating the reality. A lot of what I do is I try to show them that unconscious process so that they can go, oh, you know, so they start looking inside their own head and noticing what they're doing and the effect that it has on, you know, most people know intellectually that, you know, the people that have been in personal growth, they know that beliefs manifest themselves in reality. But until someone actually looks inside their own head and watches a belief create a certain reality, they don't really know it on an experiential level. It's just information. And I see people all the time who nod and smile as, you know, someone like you or someone like me or some of the other people we know expresses certain basic principles, and then I see them, you know, the group takes a break, and I see them violating them 2 minutes after they were nodding their head about them.
Well, you and I know that information is not enough to change behavior.
No.
That it takes an experience. That's what Moshe Feldenkrais taught us with his body work. And when the body and the mind experiences something better, it naturally goes toward that. I mean, if you've slept in a heavenly bed in a Westin hotel, you come home to your crappy bed, you go, I think I'd rather have that other bed. And so basically, you know, we will tend to move toward that which we have experienced as better. So I think what I do in my workshops anyway is to give people 7 days of experiencing what it's like to live in a constantly positive, loving, self-affirming, responsibility-taking, goal-seeking, reinforcing environment. And as people do that, it begins to become internalized, and if we give them the tools to practice, they continue it. And I think the other thing that I would say, why I love meditation so much, and for years I practiced a form called Vipassana, which is a Buddhist technique of watching not just your thoughts, but any sensation, wherever your awareness goes. You watch your thoughts for 10 days in a row in a retreat, and you become pretty clear that most of it sucks. It's really negative. And so you begin to become conscious and intentional about it. But most of us are so out of awareness, we're not even aware we're thinking. And so the concept of meditation day after day after day, and learning to be in the witness position and the observer, and then beginning to realize, wait a second, just because a thought comes through, I don't have to get on that boat and go down that river. I can let it go by, and I can now choose to think a more conscious thought. You know, one of my teachers says that it's only that our highest goal is how we feel. And our feelings are created by our thoughts. And so when we're not feeling well, or not getting what we want, then the only question to ask is, what thought would make me feel better? What thought would take me closer to my goal?
Yeah, I think, you know, awareness is really kind of the bedrock of the whole thing. One of the things that I teach is that you can only create something that does not serve you if you do it unconsciously. If you really watch the creation of something that's harmful to you, watch what you're doing inside to create it, you really cannot finish creating it. And so as long as people stay unconscious, they can keep doing the same terrible stuff to themselves for their whole life. But once they have that kind of awareness, and Vipassana is certainly one way to do it. People do it in a really accelerated way when they use Holosync every day.
Oh yeah, no, I mentioned this was years ago. I used your Holosync tapes now, and they're fabulous. But when I started, I went to a 10-day retreat, and I came out. I was like, I couldn't believe how different my life was.
Oh yeah,
and you get letters every day about how different people's lives are from Holosync. Absolutely.
Yeah, when you pay attention to what's going on in your head, you suddenly begin to make the connections between what's going on in your head and what is being created in reality. And that's a big, in fact, I think that's the, you know, I was going to ask you, you know, there's 60 or so success principles that you have in your book, the success principles. I was going to ask you what you thought was the most fundamental principle, but I'll just say that to me, the most fundamental thing is awareness. Once you have awareness, everything just falls into place.
No, it's true. My first chapter is on responsibility. Take 100% responsibility for your life. And you're accurate, because I used to teach this, that you can't take responsibility for that which you're not aware of. In other words, if I'm standing on your foot and I'm not aware of it, then at some level I'm not going to change my behavior. But as soon as you say, hey, you're standing on my foot, and I become aware of it, now I have a choice. I didn't have a choice before. Now I have a choice, either keep standing there or get off. And so people are doing all kinds of self-destructive behaviors. They're not even aware that their thoughts are creating their reality. They're not aware that certain ways they interact with people make people pull away from them. They're not aware that the way they interact with money makes them have less of it instead of more of it. And so every area where you can increase your awareness, you increase choice. That's why I love to read books. You know, I've learned a lot about finances and leadership, things I wasn't aware of until I read them. And then when I reflected on them and applied them to my own life, they made a huge difference.
So would you say then that this taking total responsibility for what you create is the most fundamental principle?
Well, you know, I put it in my book first because I think it is, but I would go back, I would have to concede to what you just said, that you have to be aware. I mean, if you're not aware you're responsible, then you can't take responsibility. Yeah. So the first thing is you have to become aware of these principles. There are universal laws. There are universal principles that, you know, have been codified in religion, have been codified in psychology, NLP, you know, all the different practices that exist in the world. And if you study them and learn them, and then you act in accordance with them, I mean, just for example, if you save 10% of every dollar you make or are given, you cannot help but end up wealthy. Even if you only make $25,000 a year, you'll be a millionaire by the time you're 65. If you invested in any kind of, you know, even conservative stock market portfolio or real estate or whatever. So that's something I never learned until I was in my 40s. No one taught it to me.
Yeah, the miracle of compounding.
Yeah, exactly. So there are laws like that, like, you know, the law of reciprocity. You know, what you give out, you get back. There's a law I call probability. The more things you try, the more likely one of them will work. The more books you read, the more likely one of them will change your life. The more of these kind of calls you listen to, the more likely you'll hear something that will improve your relationship. So the idea of abundant research, abundant exposure to new ideas, increases the probability that something will happen that's good. So, I mean, there are all these universal laws that if you know them and you are aware of them, then you can utilize them. If you're not aware of them, then, you know, you get the negative benefit, if you will, because they still work. They just work against you because you're focusing on the negative and so on and so forth.
Yeah, you know, I'd like your thoughts on something else that just occurred to me, too. One of the things that happens quite often when you first give people a glimpse of how they are creating their reality, particularly if they're creating something that is unpleasant for them and doing it, you know, chronically, they feel ashamed of themselves. They feel like they're stupid for having done this, or even they, they go into denial about it because they don't want to admit that they've been creating it. Somehow they take the fact that they're creating something negative to be a commentary about who they are as a person, rather than just that they had the wrong strategy.
Well, when we were growing up, we all learned, unfortunately, I think, that when you got caught doing something wrong, you got punished. And it meant you were a bad person, go to your room, you don't get, you know, you're grounded for a week, whatever. So we learned to avoid getting caught. And so basically when we've applied that to self-awareness, you know, catching ourselves doing self-destructive behavior. I used to do parenting workshops, and I used to have to always say in the beginning, look, I'm going to teach you lots of ways that parents unconsciously destroy the self-esteem of their children. And I'm going to teach you lots of ways to stop it. I'm going to teach you ways to consciously enhance the self-esteem of your child. You have a choice. You can either feel bad that you've been doing this stuff, or you can celebrate that you're now realizing you don't have to do it anymore. So I teach people celebrate the new awareness and let's start creating it the way you want it. Don't beat yourself up for how you used to do it. Because I believe, one of my great teachers said once, you're always doing the best you can with the awareness, skills, and resources you have, and you always did. And the literally, if you could have done better, you would have, but you were missing some awareness, you were missing some skill, you were missing some resource. But now you have a new awareness, you have a new skill, you have a new resource, so now you can do better. And people almost always choose to do better when they can. And so we never blame people for the past. We simply say you were doing the best you could with the awareness, skills, and resources you had. Now you have new resources. Let's do better.
Yeah, you know, I used to always tell people how they were unconsciously creating their reality. And then it occurred to me to add that they were creating it unconsciously and unintentionally. Mm-hmm. Because no one would intentionally create poverty for themselves or create feeling bad a lot or create being lonely and alone, things like that. No one would intentionally do that.
No, people are always attempting to do that which they think will make themselves feel better. A gang member on a street in South LA, who is robbing a 7-Eleven store, is doing it because he thinks it's going to make him feel better. He's going to have money, he's going to have respect of his gang, etc. The problem is he doesn't have the same awarenesses of ethical training that you and I have. He doesn't have the same skills that he might have not gotten in school because he was dyslexic or dropped out or, you know, got kicked out or his parents were coked out and so he has some brain damage or whatever. In other words, he's doing the best he can to meet basic psychological and physical needs. And when we give that child better skills and resources, awarenesses through education, through rehabilitation, they will choose to do better. But we can't expect them to do better ourselves or anyone else unless we have new skills, resources, and tools.
Well, and when you look around you in your community, whatever that is in your life, and you don't see very many different options, then perhaps robbing a store looks like one of the better options.
Yeah, and for some people it may be the only option that presents them with the solution to their problem. Unfortunately, our society is not very good, especially in our inner city and urban schools, in really empowering kids with the tools they need, whether it's the Hall of Sync awareness or whether it's the kind of things I teach on success principles, to give them the skills and resources to actually be able to go out in that world and be effective.
So tell me a little bit more about this new idea you mentioned earlier for another book.
Well, I basically, you know, we've been talking about it all along, that basically I think the power of our mind is so much greater than the mere power of our physical efforts. One person I interviewed recently said every hour of mental work is worth 17 hours of physical labor in terms of producing manifested results in the world. Now, I don't have a way to validate that statement yet, but a lot of people who are spiritually aware and who've been in this world of, you know, manifestation with less effort and so forth, and there are a number of people out there teaching that right now, law of manifestation, laws of,
abundance or...
Yeah, just a prosperity consciousness,
yeah.
All that stuff, that basically... There seems to be a coherence in the field of theory that this is the way it is. So one of my great gifts has always been to take things that seem a little woo-woo and far out and write them in such a way that the average person living in Iowa, Nebraska, and Oklahoma can relate to it as well as the people living on the West Coast. And so that's really what I want to do now is to I've been applying it in my own life with great success. I want to tell my own story. I want to interview lots of other people, both anecdotally and people who are doing it as their entire life philosophy, guys you and I know like Joe Vitale and others, and to then write it in such a way that the average person can understand it and apply it.
Yeah, and I think that's a really important change that needs to happen in the world is for more people to understand this. There's way too many people that are creating miserable lives for themselves, and they don't really realize that they're doing it. And it's really a shame. Looking at this thing in New Orleans, obviously the whole thing is very tragic. But one of the things I'm struck by is, and this is just a superficial observation that may not even be true, but it's what it kind of looks like seeing it on TV. it looks like a lot of these people don't feel like they have, there's no way they can do anything, so they're just kind of sitting there waiting to be helped.
No, I think that's true. A lot of people feel like there are no options. They have no alternative, scenarios that they can play out. And, again, we're looking at many people at the bottom end of the socioeconomic ladder, many of whom didn't complete school, etc. And so we go back to lack of awareness, lack of education. And I think it's a great wake-up call for the society to see how many people really are in that situation, because we tend to forget about them, drive by their neighborhoods on the superhighways and not deal with it. So I think, I agree with you. I think it's a sad commentary on the state of consciousness of a lot of people. And again, I won't hold them responsible other than that, all of us have to wake up at some point, hopefully. But usually we don't wake up until someone like a teacher comes into our life or an event like the hurricane that can be the teacher and say, wait a second, maybe we can do a better thing here than we've been doing. And I also think it's a grand statement about our government's lack of preparedness, both on the state, local, and federal level, that we don't plan for the negative. In other words, you have to have a positive attitude. You focus on what you want. But you also, I think you have to be realistic and say, well, look, let's not deny that there are going to be Category 5 hurricanes. And if it were to happen, how are we going to deal with it? You and I are constantly thinking about, well, what if this happens, then how would we deal with it? If there is a obstacle to overcome, what are our strategies? I mean, you and I learned something from Dan Sullivan called strategy circles, where you anticipate every possible negative scenario and come up with three things to overcome it. So again, you focus back on getting to what you want.
Yeah, every time that I do any kind of a project around here at CenterPoint, I and some of the other people here, we sit down and we think of all the things that could go wrong. And some people would see that as focusing on the negative, but as soon as we think of something that could go wrong, we think about how we're going to keep it from going wrong, how we're going to counteract it if it does happen. And
right.
And that keeps a lot of things from getting in the way so that we can go forward toward where we want. Ultimately, we're focused on where we want to go, but we realize that shit happens. And if you're not prepared for it, it really can take you out.
That's absolutely correct. And you do have to have contingency plans. And that's what allows you to be masterful.
Well, it's like you said, a lot of these people at the lower end of the ladder are kind of ignored. People don't like to even be reminded that those people exist. And those people sort of fall through the cracks. You know, because you've spoken for this group, one of the things dear to my heart is an organization called Self Enhancement, Inc., which is an organization in Portland, Oregon, that helps disadvantaged inner-city kids. And their motto is, life has options.
I like that.
And that's exactly what they do with these kids, is they show them that the small number of options that they see in this ghetto community are not all the options, and that the other options that they have never heard about, or if they've heard about, they dismiss them as being impossible for them, they are possible. And then, of course, as you get more and more people going through a program like they have and coming out the other end, going to college and becoming a doctor or starting a business or whatever, then other people that are in the pipeline somewhere else say, hey, other people are doing it. It's doable.
No, it's so true. And I think that's one of the things, if anyone listening to this is a parent, I mean, one of the reasons I take my kids around the world, every year we go to some other country. Last year I took my 14-year-old son to Spain and to London and to France. And at the end of that trip, he said, I think I want to live in Paris for a year when I graduate college or graduate high school. And that option didn't exist for him until he saw it. And so we want to constantly expose our kids to new options. When I was teaching in an all-black high school in Chicago back in the 1960s, most of my kids had never been more than three blocks away from their home. They had never been downtown to the Loop, downtown Chicago. They literally thought everyone in the world was black except the people on TV. And, we used to take them on field trips to the zoo, to downtown, just to get them to see that there are other options available to you. And so we have a responsibility to ourselves, to take ourselves places we've never been and expose ourselves to new people, new ideas, new cultures, new kinds of music, etc. So we're constantly seeing that we can expand into those arenas.
Well, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. You know, the big aha for me in this conversation has been what you said a little bit ago, that you can't be responsible for something you're unaware of.
Right.
To me, that, I mean, I can sort of wangle that around and think, oh yeah, I've been saying that in another way for a long time, but the way you said it, it was kind of a new idea to me, and I think that's really a very brilliant statement, and I hope you don't mind if I steal it and teach it to people.
You can't steal it because I'm giving it to you.
Okay. All right. Well, we're getting pretty close to the end of our time, and I was hoping that perhaps you could, since this is what you're best known for, maybe you could end by telling a couple of your more favorite Chicken Soup for the Soul stories.
Oh, sure. Let me think for a minute because I hadn't planned to do it, but I'm sure I can come up with some. I think one of my – I'll share two stories with you, one about the power of love and the other about the power of believing you can do anything. One of my favorite stories of all time was in the first Chicken Soup for the Soul book, and it was called Puppies for Sale. And it's about a little boy walking through a mall, and he sees a sign on a retail store, not a pet store, and says, Puppies for Sale. And so he goes inside and asks the owner if he can see the puppies. And he asks him how much they are. He says, well, I have about six of them, and there's about, I'm selling them for anywhere from 25 to 50 bucks, depending on the dog. And the little boy said, oh, good, can I see them? And he said, sure. And so he whistled, and out from the back of the store came this dog named Lady with five little tiny balls of fur behind him, or her. And little boy noticed one of the puppies was limping. And he says, what's wrong with that puppy? He said, well, that puppy, when he was born, we had him examined, and his hip sockets malformed, and he's never going to be able to run and jump and play like the other little puppies. And little boy said, well, that's the one I want. He said, how much? And he said, well, you really don't want that dog. He says, no, I really do. How much? And he said, well, if you really want him, I'll give it to you free. He says, no, sir, that dog's worth every bit as much as the other puppies, and I will pay full price. And he reaches in his pocket, and he pulls out $1.87 change. And he says, I'll give you $1.87 down, and I'll give you 50 cents a week till I have him paid for it. And the owner says, son, you're not listening. That puppy will never be able to run and jump and play with you like the other puppies. And at that, the little boy reached down, and he pulled up his left pant leg all the way up to his knee to reveal a very badly twisted left leg with a big metal brace on it. He looked the owner in the eye, and he said, well, you see, mister, I don't run so well myself, and the little puppy is going to need someone who understands. Now, that story, which I just shared with you, I want to share a little wraparound with that. A woman came up to me at a conference about 2 months ago and said she was a homeless woman living on the street. She was about to commit suicide. She'd already picked out the place on the railroad tracks where she was going to kill herself. She was pregnant. And she was described by the locals as mentally ill. She was eating out of the dumpster behind the McDonald's. And she walked by a library the day before she was going to kill herself. Said, you know, if there's a solution, it might be in a book to my problem. So she went into the library, and they were just putting out a table of inspirational books. And it was one called Chicken Soup for the Soul. She said, I picked it up, and I went over to a table, and I started leafing through it, and I found Puppies for Sale. I started to read it. And she said, when I finished that story, I broke into tears. And I realized that puppy was broken, but it didn't mean he wasn't valuable. And I realized I'm like that puppy. Just because I'm broken doesn't mean I'm not a valuable person. And she said from that day forward, she decided not to kill herself. She went and she got some help. She got off welfare. She now has a house. I believe it's in Cleveland or Columbus, Cincinnati, one of those in Ohio. She actually brings other homeless people into that house and works with them. She's now a professional speaker, and she's been on television. So the healing power of a story is very amazing.
Yeah, that's a great story. It's amazing that you can tell some of these stories without breaking up yourself.
Well, I used to not be able to tell that story without crying.
Well, I have several stories that I tell, and a couple of them are ones that I heard from you, and I get choked up telling some of them.
Well, I'll share one more with you. It's about a guy named Roger Crawford who literally was born with what I like to call a bummer of a birthmark, because I always precede it with this very funny cartoon where there's this deer with a bullseye right in the middle of his chest, and the other deer says, bummer of a birthmark, Al. And But anyway, Roger Crawford was born with one finger on his right hand, a finger and a thumb on his left hand, and his left leg had to be amputated from the knee down when he was 11. And his parents believed, like you and I believe, that anything is possible if you believe it. And so they said to Roger, nobody can do everything, but everybody can do something. What's the something that you want to do? And he said, well, I want to play football. And so his parents got down and they trained him how to play football. He wasn't going to be the quarterback, but he could definitely tackle and block. And so his dad, who had played football, taught him all that. And he went out for the team, and they eventually had to sue the school system even to let him try out. He was so good, he made first-string defensive end. And his goal was that one day he would intercept a pass and run for a touchdown. And he practiced after school every day on how to do that. Got good at it, but never had the opportunity to present itself in a game until the next to the last game he ever played, in which the quarterback faded back, threw the ball into the flat, a little too short, and Roger intercepted and started running toward the goal. Got 6 yards from his goal when someone grabbed his left leg. Roger said, I pulled, he pulled. My left leg came off because it was a prosthetic device, and he hopped on 1 foot, the final 6 yards, over to the goal. And he said, better than the 6 points was the look on the guy's face holding his prosthetic leg. But the point being that it doesn't matter what scenario you have as a current reality. Everyone's saying, well, you know, I'm poor, or I'm black, or I'm born in the South, and I'm, you know, a woman, and they're sexist down here, whatever it might be. The reality is, if Roger Crawford can learn to play football and go on with one finger and learn to become a tennis champion by duct taping the racket to his arm, and eventually was able, with a new graphite racket, to stick one finger in the groove right at the head of the racket and wedge it back with his other hand, and went on to become captain of his high school tennis team and captain of his college team, winning a full scholarship to Loyola Marymount, and winning the NCAA championship doubles tournament that year when he was a senior. Anybody can do anything. And so I always say, you know, you hear a story like that, and you go, what's my excuse? And, like, give it up, because you can give me any excuse. Blind, quadriplegic, and I can give you a story of someone with a similar condition who's gone on and created an incredibly impactful and fulfilling life. And so you know, I always just say, I go back to how you started this conversation. You said, if somebody else can do it, it must be doable. And so we always want to remember to be inspired by people who have gone for it, and keep ourselves motivated.
That's another great story. It reminds me of my attorney, Leonard Duboff, who is blind. And not only is he blind, he has a prosthetic right hand, and his other hand has 2 fingers and a thumb. And Leonard was in a chemistry lab in college, and somebody made a mistake, and there was an explosion, and he lost his sight and all of this sort of stuff. Now he is one of the top intellectual property attorneys in the world, and he has had clients including the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City and other really big name clients. And his books he's written about intellectual property law are used in most law schools, and you would never think that this guy had any kind of a handicap at all. In fact, he loves to tell blind jokes. Do you know why the blind don't like skydiving?
No.
It scares the hell out of the dogs.
That's good.
Yeah, he's a really remarkable guy, but he would have every excuse for, you know, being on disability of some kind and doing nothing. But he lives in a house in the richest part of Portland, and most of his neighbors are, you know, professional basketball players who make
on the chance of ending on a politically incorrect note, I'll tell you my favorite blind joke. A blind guy walks into Walmart and takes a seeing eye dog and starts spinning him around in the air. And one of the help comes over and says, "Sir, can I help you?" He says, "Nope, just looking."
You know, I was actually going to tell that one too, because that's my second favorite blind joke.
There you go.
Leonard also told me that one, except his happened in a bar.
In a bar.
Yeah, and he said, "What are you doing?" He said, "I'm just taking a look around."
There you go.
So, well, Jack, how can somebody get involved with what you're doing if they feel like they want to do that?
Well, they can, if they want to know more about my books and tapes and my CD programs and my summer training, which I do every year, they can go to a number of places. They can go to jackcanfield.com, or they can, that's jackcanfield.com, or they can go to successprinciples.com, or they can call our 800 number, which is 1-800, the number 2, and then the word esteem, E-S-T-E-E-M, 1-800, the number 2, and then the word esteem, E-S-T-E-E-M. And our staff will be glad to help you.
I would highly recommend that anyone listening to this go buy a copy of The Success Principles, because it really is the definitive work on how to be successful. It probably contains just about everything that all the other books on success contain. And also, I know from having spoken at them and having seen people go through them that the trainings that you have are absolutely the top of the line. They're the best in the world.
Well, thank you.
So I really do encourage people to take advantage of these resources. Jack, thanks so much for being here today and talking to me. It's really been a lot of fun, and I look forward to the next time that I will be with you, and I also look forward to the next time that I'll be with all the people that are listening.
Well, thank you, Bill. My pleasure to be with you, and my best wishes to everyone on this call.
All right, take care. Thank you so much for listening to this conversation with another of the Masters of the Secret. I know this information will help you master the secret yourself, the fact that what you focus on is created in reality. To thank you for listening, I have a very special free gift for you. As I've worked to master the secret and implement it in my own life, one of the most powerful tools I've used is Holosync audio technology, which, when listened to using stereo headphones, places the listener in deep states of meditation, literally at the touch of a button. In addition to many mental, emotional, and spiritual benefits, Holosync creates an ability to focus your mind so powerfully that manifesting what you want becomes easy. I'd like to send you a free Holosync CD so you can try it yourself, along with a free special report explaining how it works and all the amazing benefits it's created for nearly 300,000 people who've used it in 173 countries. To get your free Holosync CD, just go to themastersofthesecret.com/free CD. Remember to put the in front of Masters of the Secret. themastersofthesecret.com/free CD. Thanks again for listening, and I look forward to being with you again next time.